Let's return to our study in the book of Luke, and we are dealing with the trials of Jesus. Pilate, the Roman governor of the land of what the Romans called Palestine, was an enemy with the Jewish king, Herod. From the time of Pilate's arrival, he held Herod in contempt, and likewise, Herod held him in disdain for each other. But that all changed on the day that Pilate, after having examined Jesus, found no fault in him, decided to send him to Herod because Herod was over the region of Galilee where Jesus was originally from. And Herod wanted to hand off this case since he was dealing with these Jews that were troublemakers. So he sent him to Herod. And look what it says in Luke 23:12. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. So just sending Jesus brought sending Jesus for Herod to examine brought about this friendship between these two political leaders. Now, we are going to look at the passage that follows, verse 13 through 25 today, and examine them with the slowly asking the Lord to help us. So let's read the passage together, beginning at verse 13 of chapter 23. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us, as you can see. He has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him." With one voice, they cried out, "Away with this man. Release Barabbas to us." Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him, crucify him." For the third time, he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him." But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. Now, Pilate, the Roman governor, placed there by Caesar as the highest authority of the land, his number one concern was his reputation, and he was trying, like most Roman protectorates, trying to build his reputation so that he continued to be promoted. And he wasn't against using anything at all to make sure that reputation continued to build. Now, Herod was an extremely egotistical little man who imagined himself to be much bigger and more powerful than he really was. Other people didn't see him that way. Pilate is very, very frustrated with the Jewish court, the Sanhedrin. He has examined Jesus the first time, finds no fault with him, sends him to Herod. And Herod is a perverse king, a little puppet king. He's very perverse. And remarkably, he finds no fault with Jesus. This is really remarkable because Herod didn't like Jesus. He has no respect for Jesus. He even entered into the mockery of Jesus with his soldiers. Yet, he didn't pronounce any judgment. He sends him back saying that he also didn't find any fault with him. So when Jesus now arrives back to the Roman governor, Pilate, Pilate pronounces him innocent for the second time. Let's relook at verse 13. So Pilate calls together the chief priests, the rulers, the Jews who have originally brought Jesus to him. And he says, "You brought this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion," which was a total lie. Pilate has examined, and he says, "I have examined him in your presence and found no basis for your charges." He finds them completely unfounded. "Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him." So the Romans had a history of being fair-minded when it comes to judgment. Not because the Romans were such a good, righteous people and had a basis of Christianity to help them. They had an empire to govern. And they found that if they could hand out judgments that were fair-minded, they would have less unrest, less rioting, less destruction of property, less armies had to be sent out to squelch the riots. So they tended to ask their governors and look for governors that would hand out fair judgments. So Pilate is actually doing his duty that they've been instructed as Roman governors. And he reaches a decision, and he says, look, this man is not guilty of a death penalty, as you're asking. I'm going to release him. I am going to punish him. Now, this was something also very Roman. Anytime you got yourself caught, whether you were guilty or innocent, if you wound up in the court system, Rome would thrash you good and send you out there, and that thrashing or that beating would send a message to everyone, don't come back here. So this is no small little beating, but Pilate is wanting to release Jesus. He's wanting to appease the people. Look at verse 16, therefore I will punish him and then release him. So Pilate has this tough job of dealing with these Roman, these Jewish leaders who have actually determined they're going to kill Jesus no matter what. They have wanted him murdered for the last year of his ministry. Pilate had got off on the wrong foot with the Jews from the time he arrived in what the Romans call Palestine. So when he arrived with his army to replace his predecessor, the legions always had the image of Caesar. And the Jews considered that an idolatrous image, and so they had asked the prior Roman governors to take it down when they entered Jerusalem and passed their temple. And they had complied. But Pilate wouldn't. He was a very haughty, proud man. He wouldn't. So he kept this image of Caesar up. And the Jews started rioting. Many of them were killed. Pilate only stopped after hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them actually bowed down and said, kill us before you proceed any further. Pilate finally proceeded, but it was a massive riot. It got back to Rome, and he was reprimanded for it. Sometime later, a few years later, he needed money to build an aqueduct system into Jerusalem. It's interesting, if you go to Jerusalem, I haven't been there, but I've actually seen the videos. The Romans were there, and the aqueduct system is the modernization of society, how the Romans brought water, and it's there. And Pilate wanted to modernize his place of business and his house. He wanted water brought, and he needed money, and he didn't have it, so he robbed the temple. He sent his soldiers right into the temple, and they robbed the money. Now, that's not in the Bible, but it's in Josephus. He's the Jewish historian, and it's pretty accurate information. That sat really well with the Jews. So you can see Pilate is off to the wrong end. He has a couple more riots, and eventually he winds up killing several of the Jews over in Samaria. And eventually Caesar would have him replaced and sent somewhere else. His strategy for dealing with the Jews is what we call appeasement. You actually give the person something so they will be satisfied. Now, appeasement happens in families, it happens in schools, it happens in organizations, and it even happens in government, okay? Appeasement actually never, ever works. It's a horrible, horrible strategy, and it never, ever works. You take a child, and the child is on aisle six, throwing a tantrum for a candy bar, and there's lots of people around, and the parent is very embarrassed by it, so all right, I'll give you this candy bar. The child quits crying immediately, and the child was appeased because they got the candy bar. But the child is going to do that the next time, but maybe not for a candy bar, maybe for a bicycle. The appeasement only makes the person on the other side grow louder and more defiant. This is what the world tried to do with Hitler for years and years, appease him, not with candy bars, with countries, with whole countries. So Pilate is trying to appease the people, the Jewish people, by beating Jesus and then releasing him. But they won't have anything to do with it. Pilate seems reluctant to give in to them, and you can see he's fighting, he's struggling. Several things happen to create this reluctance. Matthew tells us a little something that's not recorded here in Luke. Matthew 27:19, when Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message. don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him. How many have had a nightmare of some kind? We used to have this couple and when we lived in Puerto Rico, and the couple would go on these, Puerto Rico is where the big cruise ships come in there. They're just in there all the time, these huge cruise ships. And so this couple in our church, he had a job, he taught golf on the ship. I don't know how they do that, golf on the ship, maybe it's putting or something, but that was his job. But he would say these cruise ships, he had food all the time. You just go from one place to the other, and they're just food. And I guess he'd overeaten, and he had a nightmare about food. And he said, in the dream, he was on the elevator, because this is like 11 stories on this. And every time the elevator opened, there'd be somebody with a big, tray of food saying, here's some food. And he was sick, and he didn't want any. He'd go to the next level, how about some more food? How about some more food? And he said, I suffered all night with that food. We've all had some kind, but this was a terrible dream for her. We aren't told a dream, but she suffers because of it. It's so powerful that she goes to her husband and say, this man is innocent. I have experienced a dream and he's innocent, and you should not have anything to do with seeing that this man is put to death, because he is not deserving of death. Well, that seems to have weighed on him. And Pilate seems very fearful of the people, of what his wife says. And so we turn to John, where there's a conversation between Pilate and Jesus, and we read this in John 19. The Jews insisted, we have a law, and according to that law, he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God. When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid. He went back inside the palace. Where do you come from? He asked Jesus, but Jesus gave him no answer. Do you refuse to speak to me? Pilate said. Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you? Jesus answered, you have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of greater sin. It's amazing. It's Pilate who's really on trial here, but you can see the effects of what was going on in Pilate's mind. We don't know what goes on in a person's mind, but we can judge by the words they say and by the actions to know what is actually going on in their mind. And there's a huge struggle here. He has a desire to save Jesus. He firmly believes he's innocent. Herod also agrees that he's innocent. His wife has had this extraordinary dream and has warned him. His conscience, which seems to be still alive in Herod and Pilate, is telling him it's not logical, but there is this mob now. These Jewish leaders have been joined by hundreds, if not thousands, of people, and they are crying as only a mob can cry. It's a frightening thing to see a mob up close. Here it is in verse 18. With one voice, they cried out, away with this man. This is a chant. Away with this man. Release Barabbas to us. And Barabbas is a murderer. He is guilty of causing riot. He's murdered people. He's in prison, and he's eventually going to be put to death. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again. Now, this mob is a fickle mob. It shows you how fickle people can be. This is the same crowd only a few days before was crying something completely different. I take you back just a few days, and we look at Luke 19:36. As he went along, Jesus, people spread their cloaks on the ground. When they came near the place where the road goes down from the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. Now here's what they are saying. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. But today they say, away with him. Release Barabbas to us. They cried out. They want Jesus. And in verse 21, it keeps growing and growing, and they say, crucify him, crucify him. This is truly the mob mentality. But what is so ironic here, Barabbas completely embodies the seditious spirit that they are accusing Jesus. They come to Pilate and say, this man has been trying to sow sedition. He's trying to cause riots, which There's nothing true in that. Barabbas is the one who has done that. And do you know what Barabbas' name means? It means son of the father. And they are crying out for the release of this man, Barabbas, whose name means son of the father. And they are rejecting the one who is really the son of the father. How ironic. What a reversal is taking place. Now Pilate, for the third time, you see, he really wants to release Jesus. He really feels he should. His wife is there. He's fearful. He's had this conversation with Jesus, and Jesus is no ordinary man. He doesn't seem intimidated. He doesn't seem frightful. He doesn't seem fearful. Hey, do you know who I am? I'm the guy who could release you or crucify you. And Jesus says, you wouldn't even have any power if it wasn't given to you by my Father. Pilate didn't know what to do with that. Now the third time, in verse 22, for the third time he spoke to them, why? What crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him. But with shouts, they insisted, demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. What happens here doesn't say in Luke, but what happens is there's blackmail that begins to take place. These Jewish leaders are very good at blackmail. And here's what John says. At this very moment, when it's reached this pitch, they go up to Pilate, as if they can get close enough, or ever how they communicated. This is what they communicated to him in John 19, 12. From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jews kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." Now remember, Caesar's not very happy with Pilate. He's had three major riots and people killed, and his job is to keep peace, not provoke the people and have endless bloodshed, because Caesar is afraid there might be a complete uprising and have to send a whole legion to put the area down. They don't want that. They want people that can maintain peace. So Pilate is kind of not in the best of position with Caesar, and the Jews are saying, look, we will make sure word gets to Caesar, all right? If you want us to give a good report, if you want us to help make sure there's no riots going forward and that you have a very good reputation here, we want this man dead. This is called blackmail, which is not above these Jewish leaders, because they're unscrupulous and they'll stop at nothing to get what they want. And they were saying to Pilate, you give us what we want here, we'll be a thorn in your flesh from here going forward. And in verse 23, they demand he be crucified, and it is their shouts that prevail. Pilate thinks to himself, I simply can't afford another riot. As bad as I hate to do this, I simply don't have a choice here. There is another historian, a very reliable historian. His name is Eusebius, and he writes in the first century, and he's the fourth century, and he says that from this point forward, Pilate's life began to take a downward spiral, and he will eventually end his life by his own hand. He commits suicide. But this is the beginning of the end for Pilate, doing what he knew to be wrong. But let's just talk a little bit about the fear of rejection, because that is what Pilate is afraid of. He's afraid of being rejected, not by the Jews. He could care less about the Jews. Who is he afraid of being rejected by? Caesar. We all have someone that we're afraid of being rejected by. The fear of rejection is perhaps one of the strongest emotions, or rejection. Even the possibility of rejection is one of the strongest emotions that any human being can ever feel. A child that grows up not liking themselves is going to be vulnerable to feelings of rejection. That's why it's so important for us to make sure that our children grow up in a home where they feel security, they feel loved, and they feel confident, and they have humility to them, and they're going to be able to handle rejection. They're going to have rejection in life. Rejection is something that exists. You can't shield your children from rejection. If you do, you are going to be sadly mistaken. The way we prepare our children is to prepare them strong enough that they'll be able to handle that rejection when it actually happens. It'll happen in the primary grades, and it'll happen in secondary. It'll happen in life. And the people who are going to be able to survive are people who are strong enough emotionally, physically, and especially spiritually. Because our real strength against the fear of rejection comes when we know that we're loved by God. That God is the ultimate one who gives us the sense of security. Because people have actually laid their life down. One of the famous martyrs, his name is Justin Martyr, and he lived during one of the greatest times of persecution when Rome unleashed this unbelievable, powerful persecution against the church. And Justin Martyr, in encouraging the church, said, "Look, they can kill us, but they can't hurt us." Now, you'd have to live there to understand what that meant. What he meant by that, yeah, they might take your home, they might even kill us, they might even burn us at the stake or kill us at the sword, but they will never hurt or take away our faith because we are secure in the Lord. So I want to tell you that Pilate appears to be in control, but he's not. This fear of rejection is actually causing him to do what he knows is wrong. That's why I think Pilate spirals out of control in his life, because he feels like he sells his soul that day. We need that spiritual, emotional strength to be able to stand up to our peers, to have convictions, to know what is right and what is wrong. For a person to actually say, "I don't know what's going to happen to me. I might lose my job. This might happen. But I have to do what's right." Where does that kind of strength come from? That comes from the kind of raising and formation that parents give their children. If you want to help your child have a successful life, teach them how to face opposition, keep their head, keep their values. They need to be right there beside you. When you're going through the trial, they need to see you keeping your head. They need to see you here in church worshiping the Lord. Parents need to have their kids with them so they can actually see in life. Don't ever shield your kids from the trials you're going through. Let them see how you depend on God and how you make the tough decisions, how you face the possibility of rejection. So Pilate grants their demand. This is a sad day, verse 24. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection. This is Barabbas. Insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. We ask ourselves, what happened here? How could this possibly? So the one reason why this happened is what I said, because of his fear of rejection. But the second reason this happens to Pilate is that he has no commitment to the truth. If we're going to make it in life, we have to have at least two things. We have to be emotionally strong enough with our anchor in the Lord and the security that our parents have had to overcome these fears of rejection. But we have to be anchored to truth. Pilate is actually a very modern person today. He would have fit very well in the 21st century because of his position on truth. Let's look. John chapter 18, because the conversation between Pilate and Jesus is more broad there. "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You are right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of the truth listens to me." Now notice Pilate's reaction. What is truth? This is the 21st century Pilate. What is truth? Pilate's of the opinion that there is no such thing as truth. He actually is skeptical of everything. He doubts everyone and everything. He distrusts, despises everything. He doesn't believe there's anything such as absolute truth. He is sarcastic. What is truth? What is this notion that there could actually be something that is true? That's what the world around you believes. And when you are out there, most people have bought into this secular notion that there is anything called truth. And the reason Pilate can't stand, even though he may have a proclivity, he may have a desire for justice to happen, we see that clearly. He would prefer that. It's his preference. Three times he announces that Jesus is innocent. He tries to appease them by having Jesus flogged and released, but they won't have it. But he has no commitment to truth. If you want to survive in this world, you will have to be committed to truth. You will have to know what is truth. Pilate was in front of truth. Truth was right there in his presence. You want to know what strength really looks like? Well, let me tell you, have you ever seen these guys with these really big, bulging muscles, kind of like that? They work out. They're just completely, you know. The guy may be physically strong. I mean, he's got the physique for it. I mean, I could be impressed. You could be impressed. But that does not speak for what kind of emotional strength. Can he control his emotional desires and passions? What about spiritual strength? What about intellectual strength? Just to have a physical strength and not have the strength in the other areas of life that really matter. Let me show you a picture of strength. Pilate on that day is a very weak man, even though he has authority. He's the ultimate authority in that entire land, even over King Herod. But he is so weak, he can't even render the decision he knows to be true. Because he has a fear of rejection, he doesn't have a commitment to the truth, and he's a weak man. So let me show a picture of a strong man. Let's take four young men you know about. One of them is Daniel, and he has three friends. They are taken against their will from their land of Israel to Babylon, about a 600-mile journey. And they're surrounded by a culture very much like the culture we live in today, a secular culture devoid of God, a pantheistic culture where there are a lot of gods but no real commitment to any of them. And there is no such thing as truth. And they are trained. They're put into the universities and being trained. Yet these four young men who were fairly young, probably 16, 17, 18 when they were taken, they never left their commitment to truth. Even when it meant dying. We know the story of the three at the fiery furnace. They were willing to be thrown into the furnace than to compromise their commitment to truth. Where does that kind of strength come from? That is so rare. What about Joseph when he is facing the temptation and the pressure from his master's wife to have an illicit affair with her, and he refuses, bringing everything down on him, everything he's worked so hard for? Where does that kind of pressure come from? That strength to resist that pressure. That's strength. That's the kind of strength that Pilate didn't have. So let me ask you, do you have the courage to follow Jesus when you're ridiculed for doing so? Pilate didn't have any kind of strength to resist the mob. Do you have the integrity to remain faithful to the truth when the opinion of the crowd is something different? So let's return to Pilate's question for just a second. What is truth? Let me make it simple. Truth is Jesus. Jesus said that. I'm saying that because Jesus said it. So let me take you to John chapter 14, verse 6. Jesus answered, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Jesus is saying in that verse, "I am the truth." So let me illustrate it. Let's say that you're new. You just arrived here for the first time. You're from some other state. You're from Tennessee or Kentucky, and you've never been to the Arch. You came up from the South, and you have no idea how to get to the Arch. And you come to me, and you say, "Would you help me?" And I say, "Okay, here's a map. You can take this map." So I would be guiding you by giving you a map. And you say, "Oh, I'm not very good with maps." I say, "Well, do you have a phone?" And you say, "Yeah." So I take your phone, and I open up a little app there called Maps. And I say, "This phone will actually help guide you there." And you say, "Well, I'm afraid of phones." And I say, "All right, I tell you what. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to get in my car and I am going to guide you. You're going to follow me." So we go out there, I drive up, and then you follow me. I have become your map. You're not using this, you're not using your phone. You're just following me. That's what Jesus is saying here. I am the truth. When you follow Jesus, you have the truth. Where is he taking us? He's taking us through life with strength, the strength to not fall in situations like Pilate did, because this bothered him and he never recovered from it. To be able to have the strength to stand. And we have to do this, not in major situations like that, but every one of us will have to face situations our whole life. The strength to be able to say yes, to say no. Not to be afraid to make somebody mad because we're doing or somebody might reject us. To live our lives with a conviction of truth. But you can't live in life if you don't know what the truth is. This whole story is really a summation of the gospel, because every one of us are sinners. Every one of us have committed sin, like it says in Romans chapter 3. The whole chapter there is about the sinfulness, the whole book. But in chapter 3, it summarizes the sinfulness. It says that we have all sinned and come short of the glory of God. It's like shooting an arrow, and the arrow didn't even hit the target. It missed, even lost the arrow. It was such a bad shot. That arrow was my life, and it was your life. We've all sinned. Like sheep, we've all lost our way. Who sinned between Barabbas and Jesus? Barabbas did. But who was freed? Barabbas. Who never sinned? Jesus. Who went to the cross? Jesus. The gospel is a story of a substitutionary death. Jesus died for sinners who sinned and deserved to have died, but Jesus took our place. So the picture, unwittingly, Pilate and everyone else was fulfilling the scripture, the story of what Jesus actually did. Later, a book is called Hebrews is written, and he's looking back on this day. He writes this, Hebrews 9:27, just as a man is destined to die once and after that to face judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people, and he will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him.